Welcome to the podcast of Media Matters with Bob McChesney, a weekly show on media from WILL Radio. Visit us at WILL.UIUC.edu.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals and institutions reach their long-term financial goals. 1-888-VANGUARD.
Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today in WILL AM 580 from beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Today we're going to turn to a core subject of our program, journalism, news media, coverage of politics, war and peace and elections, the meat and potatoes of the Media Matters listening audience. And joining us today to discuss these issues will be Lance Bennett, the author of a brand new book, When the Press Fails, Political Power in the News Media from Iraq to Katrina. Should be a great hour. I think you'll enjoy listening to Professor Bennett and what he has to say and about his new book. But before we go to that subject, let's go to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
Up in the morning in the California sun!
Up in the morning in the California sun!
Gonna strike all day till the striking is done!
Gonna strike all day till the striking is done!
About 12,000 movie and television writers represented by the Writers Guild of America East and West went on strike last week. Writers are picketing in Hollywood and New York. At issue is how writers will be paid for content they create as it is viewed in new media venues. Currently, writers are paid residuals, flat rate fees every time their show is aired on TV. As the market turns from the click of a dial to clicking a mouse, writers are asking for a percentage of the sale when their work is downloaded or streamed from the internet into computers, cellular phones, and portable devices like MP3 players. But the studios have taken a hard line. John Bowman is the chairman of the Writers Guild Negotiating Committee.
When you have a management that's as intransigent and as wrong and unwilling to be flexible as this one is, it unites us as much as anything does. I think this is an issue that crosses TV writers, screenwriters. Everybody knows how important the future is, how important the internet is. Everybody knows this is our one last chance. And they're sort of putting our backs up against the wall, and nobody's backing down.
The first casualties of the strike have been the late-night talk shows. In the coming weeks, top-rated primetime shows will begin to feel the strain. So far, reality shows, sports shows, and news programs will not be directly affected by the walkout. In solidarity with the writers, some writer-producers who run TV programs said they did not intend to perform any of their duties while the writers' strike continued. And about 500 unionized news writers at CBS are expected to vote to authorize a strike, potentially joining their creative colleagues on the picket line. The writers are represented by Writers Guild of America East and have been working under an expired contract since April 2005. Given the high stakes, the strike could continue for some time. The last strike in 1988 lasted 5 months. You can find these videos and more information about the strike at unitedhollywood.blogspot.
Chairman Kevin Martin proposed new rule changes that would gut the long-standing prohibition on owning a daily newspaper and broadcast stations in the same media market. Democratic commissioners Michael Copps and Jonathan Adelstein called the proposal a wolf in sheep's clothing that could ultimately repeal the ban in every market in America. Last week, the Senate Commerce Committee held a media ownership hearing at which numerous senators expressed their frustration with Martin's unrelenting push to get media ownership rules despite overwhelming public opposition. Democratic Senator Byron Dorgan from North Dakota and Republican Senator Trent Lott from Mississippi have introduced bipartisan legislation that would halt the FCC's rush, saying that they believe localism and diversity of media ownership is vital in a democracy.
We need to get this right. And in my judgment, the chairman of the Federal Communications Commission, having not completed the proceeding on public interest, having not completed the proceedings on localism, is not in a position where he can credibly suggest we ought to have a rule completed by the Federal Communications Commission on December 18th dealing with media ownership. That is not a thoughtful approach and not the right way to proceed.
The Media Ownership Act of 2007 requires the FCC to complete a separate proceeding on localism and create an independent minority ownership task force before moving forward with any changes to media ownership limits. The bill would also give the public a 90-day comment period on any new rules. Senators co-sponsoring the bill include presidential candidates Barack Obama, Joe Biden, and Hillary Rodham Clinton, as well as Olympia Snowe, John Kerry, Bill Nelson, Maria Cantwell, and Dianne Feinstein. On November 9th, the FCC held its final public media ownership hearing in Seattle. Despite Chairman Martin's attempt to squelch public input by giving barely a week's notice for the hearing, more than 1,100 people kept the FCC commissioners busy for 9 hours as they spoke out against further media consolidation. Washington Governor Kris Gregoire said she was opposed to further concentration.
Such concentrations stifle creativity. They stifle content. It narrows perspectives available to each of us as citizens, and it is clearly unhealthy in a society that rests on principles of equality and diversity. I find it ironic that in an age with so many new ways for people to communicate and so many ways to exercise the literal beauty of democracy, we face the very real threat that those new ways will be controlled by but a few.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Okie dokie. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today in WILL AM 580, this Sunday, November 25th, 2007. Less than a year away from the 2008 congressional and presidential elections here in the United States. Welcome to all of you in podcasting land, too. I get lots of emails from folks out there in the podcast world who listen to the show. And hope you enjoy today's show, too. Our guest today is the author or the co-author of a brand new book, When the Press Fails, Political Power in the News Media from Iraq to Katrina, co-authored by our guest W. Lance Bennett. Lance Bennett, also with Regina Lawrence and Steve Livingston, the other two co-authors. Lance Bennett is a professor of communication at the University of Washington. His co-authors, Lawrence and Livingston, are professors of political science, respectively, at Portland State and at George Washington University. Lance Bennett, welcome to Media Matters.
Thanks much, Bob. Good to talk to you again.
Well, it's always great to talk to you. And the title of your book is When the Press Fails. Maybe the place to start is talk about what does it mean when the press succeeds? What are we looking for from a successful press?
Well, I think we saw glimpses of it during coverage of Katrina, that brief shining and regrettably catastrophic moment when natural catastrophe struck and governmental catastrophe followed. You saw journalists from major news organizations challenging the government, explaining to the government what was going wrong with its response to Katrina. That doesn't happen very often, and I think it happened in Katrina only because the level of government failure was so palpable, the level of human suffering on the part of American citizens was so real, and the government was so clueless. But if it takes that level of a perfect storm, if I can use that phrase, to produce a viable press, the democratic backup system that the press should be providing is in deep trouble.
Your argument is that the press fails now, and we're going to go through it at length on today's program, Lance Bennett, but is part of the argument that it's deteriorated, that we had a higher quality press system, or it did a better job of serving the needs of a self-governing people in the past than it's doing today, that we're in the process of deterioration, or has this simply basically been the way all along?
I think that singing the praises of the press from the era of the Cold War would be overstating it, although one can argue that a system that was not always succeeding in those days is doing a far worse job today. Another way of looking at that question is to note that there have been historic moments in the last century in which a critical aggressive press existed with a large audience following it, the lamentably named muckraking era. The muckrakers didn't call themselves that. Teddy Roosevelt, the great reformist president, when elected, labeled the muckrakers, the Upton Sinclairs and Ida Tarbells and company, with that term as a means of getting them to back off their aggressive criticism of corporate and government America. But during that time, you had magazines such as McClure's that had a popular circulation equivalent to U.S. News and World Report, controlling for population growth today. So there have been eras. I think that the late 60s through Watergate into the early 80s was another period in which investigative journalism became institutionalized. Most major news organizations had investigative units. There were critical documentaries, sometimes documentaries such as the selling of the Pentagon and documentaries on the Vietnam War incurred the wrath and legal retaliation of government. Those seem to me to be signs of a healthier press.
Our guest today, Lance Bennett, the co-author of the brand new book, When the Press Fails, published by the University of Chicago Press. Lance Bennett joining us from Seattle, his home, where he's a professor of communication at the University of Washington. If people want to call in to speak with Lance Bennett, the phone number here at Media Matters is 333-9455, our toll-free number 1-800-222-9455. Lance Bennett has written numerous books about news and politics, probably most famously News, the Politics of Illusion, which is, how many times has that been printed now, Lance?
I am entering the eighth edition, and I need to get started writing on it very soon.
Well, I'm sorry to take you away from that, but it's our benefit to have you for the next hour. A book that's really one of the textbooks for understanding how journalistic codes developed and are applied, and the weaknesses as well as the strengths with them. Really, a lot of what you're talking about in this book that you've written with Regina Lawrence and Stephen Livingston. Let's go into this book. I mean, as I understand it, Lance, a lot of the book, as I read it, was really a critique of how well the Bush administration was able to script the news coverage on a number of issues, but in particular the invasion of Iraq.
Yeah, that's right. The story has two major episodes. First is the amazing degree to which the mainstream press, with a couple of notable exceptions, which are important to note, followed the scripting of the Bush administration and then realized that the war really had a reality rather different than the administration's fairy tale about the liberation of Iraq and the coming of democracy in the region. And then the end of that episode was the apology of the major news organizations involved in basically passing along propaganda as news to the American people. So both the Post and the Times apologized for kind of missing another side to the story. But then, and this is what our perspective predicted and why we really wrote the book, I talked to my co-authors and said, I believe that the press is incapable of learning from this episode in a way that matters in terms of notable change in news coverage. And so I said, I predict that the next time a major event of potentially catastrophic proportions emerges, that unless the government produces an opposition from within, the press will be incapable of resisting administration spin again. And so that brings us to the second chapter of the story, which is Abu Ghraib and torture. Mm-hmm. And sure enough, even though the press did well in the sense of continuing to release photographs of those horrific scenes from Abu Ghraib over a period of months in the summer of 2004, the Democrats, once again, the most obvious source of an opposition from within the government, decided to take a pass on the issue for political reasons, not because they likely doubted that torture was going on. And the press ended up reporting administration spin again, which blamed the entire episode on low-level, poorly trained soldiers run amok who were punished. But that's where the story stopped, at that level, until, of all people, John McCain mustered an opposition from within the Republican ranks in the Senate to challenge Bush after the 2004 election was over, on the evolved policy of torture. And then the press called it torture. So in a way, the story of the book is that the press is incapable of developing an independent perspective on such issues unless the government itself is really doing its job of policing itself.
Now, this is an argument, at least as you've explained it so far, that is, you know, compatible with a lot of the major criticism that's been generated over the past three or four decades of professional journalism, with its reliance upon official sources as what is legitimate news is, and people that basically gives the power to people in power to define what a legitimate story is and how it will be covered and what type of coverage you get. Is that basically the thrust of your argument?
Yeah, that is the thrust of the argument. But in a way, it formalizes that proposition so that we can explain the very wide range of press responses to different issues.
Mm-hmm.
So if you look at issues such as abortion or taxation and many other domestic policy issues about which we've had roaring political battles, you see a very wide spectrum of voices, including social movement organizations, grassroots groups, getting access to the news. But when the range of institutional conflict is narrowed, and often for dubious reasons, as it has been on the Iraq War and other foreign policy issues, you end up getting a very restricted story, even though just outside the boundaries of U.S. institutional power, there may be credible sources with documentary evidence attached that could provide other sides to the story, such as U.N. weapons inspectors saying, hey, we aren't finding any weapons over here. Give us a little bit more time in the run-up to the Iraq War.
Our guest, Lance Bennett, co-author of the brand new book, When the Press Fails, Political Power in the News Media from Iraq to Katrina. Lance, I couldn't help but notice that the book is dedicated to Tim Cook. And maybe you could just say, who is Tim Cook and why did you dedicate the book to him?
Well, Tim Cook is a dear friend and colleague who tragically died last year. And Tim was an inspiration to many of us who study the media and politics. And his legacy lives on in this book. I think Tim's most important contribution to our understanding press politics in the United States is to talk about the news media not as a group of competing, fiercely aggressive organizations trying to find the truth, but rather as a unified institution that covers news in a very homogeneous way because of each organization's systematic dependence on government for framing stories.
Yeah, and Tim Cook's work was also has been very influential on me, which is one of the reasons I was delighted to see the acknowledgement because he did die at such a tragedy.
Bob?
Yes.
I'm losing you. Can you turn up the volume on your end?
I think we can do that here. Yeah.
Okay. I am having trouble hearing. And
okay.
Well,
at any rate, can you hear me now, Lance Bennett?
Better. Yes. Thanks.
Wonderful. Our guest again, Lance Bennett. And if you'd like to call into Media Matters with the questions for Lance Bennett, the number here, 333-9455, our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Lance, we've been talking about how the press has covered the Iraq War and basically followed the Bush script, and your book goes into a great deal of detail delineating this. And one of the questions I think that automatically comes up is, and you know, the United States has been in numerous wars over the past century, 110 years, isn't this the pattern of all those wars? Doesn't the news media almost always line up with whatever the government says, even though we know in most cases, as in this case, the causes given to the public, at least, to justify the war are usually half-truths at best and oftentimes outright lies?
Yeah, I think there is that tendency. Certainly World War I was a modern classic of the news media participating in propaganda to turn a peace president into a war president, in the case of Woodrow Wilson, and the management of the public relations involved centrally many journalists, such as Walter Lippmann, one of the great journalists of modern times. World War II was a repeat of that. But it seems to me that following World War II, there became more concern on the part of the press about its too cozy relations to government and its increasing ownership by corporate media, so that an independent press became, I think, a growing concern for many journalists themselves. And following the war, we had the Hutchins Commission report, which was a very interesting proceeding that ended up producing a very contemporary critique of modern media from that point in the 40s to date, albeit the combination of corporate and government resistance ended up making the impact of that report very small indeed. So there's been a growing concern about the conversion of the press into a propaganda arm of government during these kinds of crises. But I think a turning point was Vietnam, in which finally the press got the story. Once again, it got the story because opposition from within government both opened the story to the press and made it possible to create sources and to create story-advancing mechanisms that finally exposed the many failures of Vietnam policy, somewhat too late to have prevented the catastrophe that occurred, as we are currently suffering the Iraq situation. So I think that there is perhaps a healthier tension between the press and the government, given the dubious nature of some of the post-World War II military adventures. But the capacity of the press to fully stand back and present other sides of the story is still in doubt.
You talk in the book, or you write in the book, Lance Bennett, about groupthink of the Bush administration and the capacity the Bush administration has to really set the terms of debate and our understanding of these issues and how the news media cooperate quite willingly. And you talk about the weaknesses of the Democratic Party, which are the sort of source of the legitimate opposition that journalists need to have, and the way the system works, to be critical of the Bush administration. I was wondering, as I read that, is it a level playing field? Does a Democratic president, say Clinton in the 1990s, or whoever the next president might be if it's a Democrat, would they basically have the same leverage as Bush? Is it independent of who the president is, or does it matter if they're a Republican or a Democrat?
That's a really good and tricky question. My best view of it, and I have to say that my view may well be as biased as that of any other American, given that we all tend to see the center of reality from our own viewpoints, but trying to look as critically as possible at that question, it seems to me that the Republicans for the last 30 years have waged an incredibly effective public relations offensive against the press, meaning that journalists who are mostly, although this is actually changing a bit in the elite press, but most journalists are still liberals and vote Democratic, but they also operate within systems that discipline their coverage quite significantly so that their personal views become cleansed in many ways as stories go on to the front pages. So the answer, I guess, is that it is easier for the press to scandalize a Democrat than a Republican, simply because the Republicans have a really well-organized public chorus that includes talk radio, which has, on the conservative side, 30 million or so active listeners, and other publications and media channels, Fox, for example, that can create a wall of response when Republicans turn out to be scandalized. So, for example, many of the news events that have plagued leaders in recent years that have been spun by opposition research seem to stick most to the Democrats. So there was the swift voting of John Kerry, which turned into a news story rather than be put to rest as a series of distortions and lies. there was turning Al Gore into a serial exaggerator, if not liar, depending on which Republican channel you chose to filter that story. There was the continuous scandalization of the Clinton regime from the early days of Travelgate and haircuts on the tarmac through the impeachment process. And similar efforts, even if the Democrats have the audacity to gear them up, which I think they don't stick.
Our guest, Lance Bennett, co-author of the brand new book, When the Press Fails. You're listening to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, on WILL AM 580. We're coming to you live today, which means we can take callers. The phone lines are open, 333-9455, our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Lance Bennett, the author of numerous books on journalism and the news media and politics, going back, dare I say it, Lance, several decades now. And the most famous of which, News, the Politics of Illusion. And in all your work, and including in this book, and I think you really develop it in this book, you talk a lot about the professional codes of journalism. What you write about here are the unwritten rules of D.C. reporting, of Washington, D.C. News reporters, political reporters, and how important they are. And I sort of was thinking of that movie, the one with Jack Nicholson and Demi Moore and Tom Cruise, where, you know, he says, you can't handle the truth.
Yeah,
about the rules, the unwritten rules that are followed in the military. And in a way, it's sort of like that for the news business in Washington, isn't it?
Yeah, I think that's right. The good news and the bad news about when the press fails, is journalists have engaged with it, because I think most journalists understand that, the reporting from the invasion of Iraq, actually from 9/11 to date, and looking ahead to Iran, is missing important other sides to these stories. On the other hand, when journalists have engaged with the book, they tend to not be able to talk about the main point. The point being that journalists are so close to power that power becomes reality in the news, as opposed to looking beyond power to see what other realities might exist out there. And so the most common journalistic response to the book is, well, what did you expect? Did you think we could have stopped the war? And nowhere in the book do we say that. In fact, in several places in the book, we say our point is not that we expect journalists to be able to single-handedly stop a war. That, in many ways, is absurd. We simply expect journalists to do the job that they claim they do in this democracy, which is to tell all documentable sides of a story that might bear on the public's understanding and capacity to act in a timely fashion.
Well, Lance Bennett, what are the unwritten rules? What are some? Give my listeners a flavor of what you mean when journalists follow unwritten rules.
Well, I think that journalists have a publicly stated norm of being adversarial and indeed very competitive. But what that often turns into in practice, given the unwritten understanding that the reality that they write about is the official reality of government, that journalists compete aggressively for small tidbits that often unnamed sources may offer them on Air Force One or in a special meeting in the Pentagon, with perhaps an informant who claims that there are weapons of mass destruction. A curveball comes to mind in this context. And so that what competitive journalists end up doing is competing for spin rather than competing for news stories that give the public some perspective on spin. So the unwritten rule is that you are competing for the best official source available that is most likely to convince your editor that you've got the headline-making story. The Judith Miller episode with the New York Times comes to mind. So Judith Miller consistently reported straight-out spin and got those stories into the headlines of the New York Times, when there were many stories that could have been reported that openly would have contradicted those reports.
You know, sometimes I think the success of the Jon Stewarts and Stephen Colberts, as well as a whole bunch of political comedians, is based on the fact that they simply don't have to hold to the unwritten rules.
They don't have to obey the unwritten rules. That's exactly right. Yeah, there have been some interesting studies recently of the audiences. You know, many people worry, teachers often worry that their students are fans of Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert, and worry that they're getting their news from these comedians. And in fact, the audiences for those shows tend to be among the most informed and most politically engaged audiences in the whole American public. And the effect of those shows seems to be simply to offer people perspective that the New York Times cannot.
Our guest, Lance Bennett, again co-author of the brand new book, When the Press Fails, Political Power and the News Media from Iraq to Katrina, just published by the University of Chicago Press. A terrific read, and if I may say so, a really, in a way, it's a development of your work of your career, Lance Bennett, but also it encapsulates, too, I think, a lot of what you've done now for decades. In making one of the strongest critiques of professional practices of journalism that I'm familiar with. So I urge listeners eager to learn more about this to get a hold of a copy of When the Press Fails. Lance Bennett, you know, one of the big developments in the last 10 years certainly distinguishes the Iraq War and the Bush administration and Katrina and Abu Ghraib from any of the episodes in American history has been the emergence of the blogosphere, the internet, all these new sources of news and information and ways people can communicate to each other outside of the bottleneck of commercial news media or major public news media. How does that affect your model or your view on how these issues take place? Is that going to be sort of our way out of this impasse?
I don't think the blogosphere is going to get us out. I think that there are new forms of citizen journalism that hold some promise. To challenge the media, the commercial media, but the blogosphere the information tends to flow from the top down rather than from the bottom up. I mean, there have been some very interesting examples to the contrary. For example, the scolding of Trent Lott, the discovery that documents that CBS reported as authentic records of George W. Bush's Air National Guard service turned out to be fake. Those were clear examples of bottom-up impact from the blogosphere to the mainstream press. But most of what the blogosphere talks about is a kind of a rehash of the headlines of the day. It's a very useful rehash, and perhaps for the first time, journalists have alternative platforms in which they can talk about the behind-the-scenes aspects of news, and also make contact with their audiences so that they have a sense of a real public as opposed to an imagined ideal of a public. But the blogosphere itself, I don't think, has become detached enough or, in a way, self-organizing enough to challenge conventional media. I think that the experiments with citizen-driven news are much more interesting, although the jury is still out on whether they will become viable, because the question, after all, becomes, can you do journalism without access to government? I'm not even close to suggesting that journalists should abandon focusing on the government, but simply hold the government accountable via other sources of information in terms of helping the public evaluate its actions. So whether citizen journalists can ever have the access that mainstream news organizations are currently not using very critically, I think is the question.
I mean, if we look realistically, what's facing this country in terms of foreign policy in the next few years, an immediate horizon, in fact, with relations most specifically with Iran, but also with this government's stated antagonism towards Venezuela and North Korea and some other countries. Is there any sense you've got that the citizen journalists or blogosphere can provide sort of an alternative source of information to undercut the Washington consensus of journalists sort of spoon-feeding whatever the administration is saying?
Well, again, I think the critical question there is access to information. It depends also a bit on what area of issues we're talking about. I think that there's probably better environmental information, for example, on all kinds of environmental issues that can be obtained through the internet than is likely to be obtained through the mainstream media. And perhaps the audiences in positions to act on that information are also substantial enough to really make a difference. Information that comes in a timely fashion that has an action opportunity attached to it may be a new emerging form of citizen info engagement, if you will. And I see that in a lot of areas, but in terms of big government policies that really continue to affect our lives, whether we're talking about healthcare or war, the news still really needs to look at the Washington arena. And indeed, journalists could do what some today are doing. I mean, you know, there are still Seymour Hersh's who are producing very good information in a timely fashion, even though publishing in a magazine, such as New Yorker. There's Mark Danner, who got the story right on torture consistently in the New York Review of Books. But even though those publications may be, you know, of considerable cachet among certain audiences, they're still relatively small audiences.
Well, I mean, also the point I would think, Lance Bennett, is that when stories like Seymour Hersh's are broken, rather than leading to a firestorm of journalists from major news media pushing the story along and demanding answers and taking it further, it seems like they sort of dry up fairly quickly once it gets pretty far, you know, very far out of Seymour Hersh's eyesight.
Yeah, the idea that a good investigative report will kind of engage the mainstream press is just not true. Hersh offered many, many well-documented reports on the war, really from the run-up through the conduct, through the catastrophe that was happening before the mainstream press got the story. And none of those to the torture scandal, to the pending attack on Iran. So Hersh has kind of gotten all of that right by just practicing good old-fashioned journalism. But the mainstream press won't touch it, or if they touch it, it rattles around for a day or two and then falls back outside the boundaries. The boundary maintenance is very, very clear in terms of what constitutes the mainstream press and what constitutes opinion press and alternative press. And as long as those boundaries are hard and fast, as they seem to be, the American public will always have a choice between joining the consensus or being on the outside of it. So in a way, the ironic choice for the citizen in the American media democracy today is to join a consensus that may well be based on spin and deception, or to remain on the outside, kind of knocking and trying to get in, but not having the platform, the media sounding board, necessary to get the attention of the majority of Americans who are watching American Idol.
Our guest today, Lance Bennett, co-author of the brand new book, When the Press Fails. I'm Bob McChesney. You're listening to Media Matters on WILL AM 580 from beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Lance, this gets at really one of the really interesting parts of your book. In Chapter 5, you call it Managing the News, which really deals with how this sort of consensus view of presenting the government position, or in this case, in the Iraq War, the Bush administration position, is sort of made the consensus. And, you know, what happens to that dissident reporter, potentially dissident reporter, in a news bureau in Washington so that they end up basically following the company line? How does that work?
Well, how it works is your stories end up on page 24 if they run at all, as opposed to your colleague who's got the inside source who gets page one. And so you hear these complaints from journalists. The number of good journalists in Washington who struggle against this system, Donna Priest, Walter Pincus. So the Post is not lacking in good reporters. The problem occurs above their level, where editors decide what the most dramatic headline-making inside story about power in government is. And these journalists have to struggle very hard. In many cases, they lose those fights. And when they win them, their story may appear on page 24 and not continue beyond one or two installments because the paper doesn't sense that the government power trend is moving in that direction.
our guest Lance Bennett. The phone number here, 333-945, toll-free, 1-800-222-9455. Lance Bennett is the co-author of the brand-new book, When the Press Fails. Let's go to the phone lines right now. Line 1, Champaign County, you're on the air with Lance Bennett.
Hi, yeah, I want to present another test case. You were talking about how Cy Hirsch does an expose and nothing happens. I'm preoccupied with the war on Iran, which Juan Cole actually says, are we already at war? And one of the things that Hirsch has talked about is the aid to groups either inside Iran or on the border. I mean, a lot of people are preoccupied with the Kurds attacking Turkey, but there's actually many more people being killed across the border into Iran. The Iranians are fighting the PJAK, P-J-A-K, and I wasn't surprised. I just did the Google News search, and there's absolutely no American press that has mentioned it in the last week or so. The Times, which I did a direct search for them, they have one story from the 23rd of October, which was broke the silence for them on this other front, and there's nothing following it. It's a story from October 23rd by a guy named Richard Opel, I guess. And that's the only mention of this group. This is an ongoing battle that the U.S. is probably aiding either directly or through Blackwater types shipping weapons or Israeli Mossad support for this attack. This is only one of six we've heard on these airwaves of these kind of things, and there's just no mention of it in the press at all. There were very few, actually, European comments on this in the Google News search. I guess I can click it around. I'm confident when I go to the Washington Post I'll find very little, but maybe, as you mentioned in a blog by William Arkin or Dana Priest or something like that. So I don't know if that's a question, or I just would like for you to respond to that. I did do a search about a week and a half ago, and I found a McClatchy news feature that mentioned PJAK, not really emphasizing the aspect of the story, but just mentioning the group. And it was published in very few papers. In fact, surprising to me personally, it was in the Belleville News Democrat, not a major paper. There was nothing in any major city paper that actually is talking about this issue. And it's an ongoing, as Juan Cole says, we're already at war. Thanks for your efforts, and I'll hang up and listen.
Lance, if I can just interject then, it seems to me that what the caller is saying is, you know, it looks like you've got another chapter for the next edition here that follows. You know, it's much like Abu Ghraib following the Iraq invasion. After all these apologies that we're going to get it right next time, are we in fact repeating history again in Iran?
Well, the not-so-funny implications of that for our book, as I've told my co-authors a couple of times, is that the second edition will have the Iran chapter and should be titled When the Press Fails Again. And Iran has so many similarities to the run-up to Iraq, the Bush administration claiming advanced weapon development. It seems that the basis for that claim are better than in the case of Iraq. But again, with UN weapons inspectors saying, but they're not there yet, it may be 5 years, give us some more time. Time is running out, quite literally in this case, for the Bush administration. If they want to take action, they've got carrier groups in the region that could accomplish the strike. There seems to be no planning associated with what if Iran responds by attacking Israel, and you have a regional and then a world war scenario. You know, these are questions that might be raised in the press as cautionary notes to, if nothing else, encourage Democrats to step up and echo them and to raise their importance on an election agenda that still appears to be driven more by domestic than international crisis issues. And so in response to the caller's question, I think he's absolutely right. Interestingly enough, McClatchy was the only newspaper group that got the challenges to the Bush invasion scenario of Iraq right in the first place. If anyone saw the Bill Moyers postmortem earlier in the year on coverage of Iraq, you know, Moyers credited McClatchy as the the group that got it right. So stories are available to be reported. It's just that McClatchy is so far down on the food chain of the elite press, which is governed by the Times and the Post on political stories, Wall Street Journal and on other areas, that the national media consensus, which becomes a kind of a surrogate public opinion in the eyes of policymakers and indeed many of the public themselves, the impact of those rare moments of exceptional reporting tend not to be great unless they happen at the top, and these days they rarely do. So I see Iran as developing much as the caller describes it, unreported. The administration is playing it under the radar, so to speak. And if there is a war, one can expect the press to move much as it did with Iraq. And the result is that the Democrats once again will probably collapse as an opposition because they're not fully an organized opposition to this war. They can't produce the votes in the Senate needed to override vetoes, and so the story will be told out of the White House again.
It seems that, you know, in one hand, and correct me if you think I'm wrong, but my sense from listening to you and reading your book, on one hand, the Democrats are necessary to provide opposition for journalists to have the sources so they can stand up to the official line. On the other hand, if the Democrats don't provide a very strong opposition from the top of the party that journalists can hang on to, then journalists, in fact, not only represent the government line, the Bush administration line, they have to sort of defend it since it's their line. And then there's a recalcitrant Democrat, an oddball, a Kucinich or someone. They've got to discipline them for being outside the range of legitimate debate.
Oh, that's absolutely true, and sadly so. I recall a story in the Washington Post around the time that the New York Times broke the National Security Agency secret spying story a couple of years back. And even though the Democrats were then out of power, this was in 2005, I believe, even though the Democrats did not have power in the House, John Conyers of Michigan decided to hold a hearing. I mean, in hearings, if you're on the minority, really are more publicity events, but at least in this case, publicity might well be drawn to a case of potentially illegal government spying on American citizens. So Conyers held a preliminary hearing, and the Washington Post story on this hearing led with the paragraph, something to the effect that Michigan Democrat John Conyers is playing house. So they turned it into a joke. Rather than note that there was at least somebody on duty in the government paying attention to this story. In fact, that story was so volatile to report that the New York Times sat on it at the behest of the administration for 1 year, and then only reported it because its own reporters, and this goes back to the Walter Pincus and Donna Priest and other stories about why journalists who struggle against an organization often can't win the fight if the government spin is overwhelmingly to the contrary. The Times was going to be scooped by its own journalists who were coming out with a book, and that would have been terribly embarrassing for the Times to have sat on a story that came out as a book exposing the government program.
Our guest is Lance Bennett, co-author of the brand new book, When the Press Fails, Political Power and the News Media from Iraq to Katrina, published this year by University of Chicago Press. I urge people to read it. Bennett's co-authors, Regina Lawrence and Stephen Livingston. I'm Bob McChesney. This is Media Matters. We've only got about 10 minutes or so left. There's so much ground I want to cover with you, Lance, about the effects of all this on our political culture and political involvement by the citizens and about what we can do about it. But while we have you here, I feel it's imperative that I take advantage of this to talk about where we're logically moving with this discussion, which is news media coverage of politics and candidates and political races. Here we are going into a presidential race, and every 4 years we're told it's a pivotal presidential race of paramount importance for the future of the country and humanity. And if that those words were ever used, I think this one will certainly qualify as well. And one of the things that's taken place in the last few months is that the candidates for the Republican and presidential Democratic presidential nomination have held periodic debates. And I've had the privilege to watch a few of those. And they're generally run by news media, and the news media do the questioning and or pick the questions to be used. And I know you follow this, too. How does this fit in with your argument about news and news culture in Washington?
Well, I think the presidential race is interesting in a couple of senses, and the first one doesn't get us directly back to the Washington news culture, although it in a way talks about another aspect of it, which is that both of the parties spend a lot of campaign resources on opposition research, digging up dirt, in other words, on their opponents, and then trying to spin it to the press. And often this spin takes on a life of its own as journalists develop a consensus that the American people are really more interested in character than on policy issues, and besides, the candidates say the same things every day about the policy side, so there isn't any news there. I mean, journalists who cover campaigns are scratching their heads for news because the campaigns are on script. I mean, this isn't all a journalist problem. It's partly the political process at work. Campaigns are scripted. The message is the same. There's no news. But what becomes news is the opposition research that suggests Howard Dean is crazy, or that suggests Al Gore is a serial liar, that he invented the Internet. And these become very interesting news stories because they circulate. They're water cooler stories, as opposed to what was Al Gore's environmental program anyway. So campaign coverage often becomes meta narratives, meta stories that journalists decide are the real stories of the campaign. John Kerry's war record, for example, which was clearly the product of opposition research and rather shabby work at that, became the meta-narrative that Kerry never shook off through the entire campaign. So that's one aspect of Washington journalism, which is where journalists actually do get to create the news, albeit often very misguided ways. But the second element of campaign coverage, which seems to me to be really important, is that when these kinds of charges start flying, when opponents start accusing, or when their Greek chorus in the talk show media start accusing a candidate of some terrible character flaw, the Howard Dean craziness or the John Kerry lack of patriotism, can journalists actually tell the truth? Can they sort the truth out? Can they find the truth and balance it and help the American voters come to some reasonable judgment, or do they simply let the specter of doubt hang over those candidates with the result that it often edges the election in a close case, which we've had in the last few, one way or the other? So I think that the ultimate flaw in the American journalist ointment, so to speak, is the incapacity to manage the truth. Back to your line, can you handle the truth? Can journalists handle the truth in this country?
And I want to go to our phone lines. We have one patient caller who just called in I want to get to. But before we do, real quickly, Lance, I guess what I was thinking about was watching the last two Democratic presidential debates over the last few weeks, one hosted by Tim Russert and the most recent by Wolf Blitzer from our major commercial news media. And just being struck by the degree to which the questioning, especially in the Blitzer debate, was sort of directed out of sort of the mainstream Washington consensus of what the real issues are. And so much of them were really these inside baseball issues between which candidates ahead in the polls and who's slinging mud, and how little there was actually about engaging issues that most people actually care about.
I think increasingly journalism today is about inside baseball, and that's one of the reasons that is lost such approval from the American people. You know, the government and journalism today are kind of competing for low approval ratings from the American people, and there's a lot behind that, more than just the issues that we're talking about. But I think that this factors in, is that the press increasingly talks to each other, not to the American public, and the press increasingly talk to each other about inside strategies in Washington and the power game in Washington. And it becomes fascinating for them, even as news audiences shrink. And it is, they are so locked into the fascination and preoccupation with the inside game that they're losing news audiences, but can't seem to help it.
Well, let's go to the phone lines now to take our final caller. Line one, Urbana, you're on the air with Lance Bennett.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call. I'm calling sort of with a concern that's sort of an outgrowth of your the picture you paint and that others paint and that I believe is accurate, which is that it leaves one with a very gloomy outlook if one is trying to believe in democracy. What cause is there for hope if the blogosphere is pretty iffy and the citizen initiatives are immature and the mainstream media is basically broken as I'm hearing? What is there that we can look to fill the gap?
Wonderful, important question to end our conversation on. I guess my first reaction to that is I'll put in a plug for some of the wonderful work that Bob McChesney has been doing on media reform. I mean, this is an issue that people sort of see the media as kind of an invisible link to other issues, but indeed Bob has focused a large social movement's attention on the importance of the media itself as an issue and reforming ownership and perhaps reimposing some social responsibility standards, since the media seem incapable of finding their own standards in this area. So I guess that media reform, it does take some action. I mean, the pessimism is only for those who expect the media to reform itself. I don't think that will happen. I think that is a very pessimistic prospect. But the more optimistic look, I think, comes from recognizing the importance to democracy of an open and diverse media with access to different perspectives that don't happen to be spun out of Washington. And joining some reform effort. I mean, there are lots of ways in which this can happen. They don't all need to involve visiting congressional representatives, although that's a good start. Most representatives do visit their home districts and do receive delegations about issues such as this. But also contributing to campaigns for media reform so that others may join this lobbying effort becomes as important, I think, as contributing to electoral campaigns for candidates.
Lance.
So I think that's the optimistic path. And also there are other ways for citizens to act effectively these days, thanks largely to the Internet, organizations such as Move On, which have organized hundreds of thousands of people effectively to take action on everything from war and peace issues to electing candidates and disciplining the Democratic Party to try and be more coherent and responsive.
Lance Bennett, I feel like I'm auditioning for Tim Russert's performance here in the debate, because we only have like 10 seconds left, but have you noticed in your dealings with professional journalists over the last two decades more sympathy for the critique you're making than when you first made it, say, in the mid-1980s?
I think journalists are more aware today that they're not practicing journalism as happened in the 1980s with more investigation and more adversarialism. Most journalists today recognize that the media have a problem, but they can't figure out how to change it from within.
Well, on that note, unfortunately, Lance Bennett, the lightning round of our show is over. Lance Bennett, author of When the Press Fails, thank you so much for joining us today on Media Matters. I'm Bob McChesney. I want to thank Andrew Boyle, my producer. I'll see you all in 167 hours. We're going to have Robert Kuttner as our guest then. Have a great week, everyone.
Thanks, Bob.
Thanks, Lance.
To Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance. Private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings, or other special events. Lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
Mostly cloudy with a chance of rain in the afternoon. This is in the forecast for Champaign-Urbana and the area. The high around 42 and southerly winds up to 10 miles an hour. And it looks like a rainy evening tonight, but it won't be as cool with a low around 37 degrees. Easterly winds up to 10 miles an hour. Tomorrow morning, showers continue to come into the area. In the afternoon, rain may change into snow. The high around 42, north winds up to 15 miles an hour. This is WILL Urbana, the broadcasting service of the College of Communications at the University of Illinois.
From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smythe. It's the time of the year when American families spend a lot of time eating and drinking, but it's also the time when the USDA releases its annual stats on hunger. Today we'll talk about the myths and realities of hunger.
35 million Americans is a significant number of people who don't know where their next meal is going to come from, and it's a serious problem.
Poor households face a lot of significant problems. Chronic food shortage is not one of those problems.
Also, as we count down to the Iowa caucus, commentator Catherine Lopez looks at the Republican to-do list. Then, as the holiday shopping countdown begins, filmmaker Morgan Spurlock asks, what would Jesus buy? Plus, commentator Eddie Glaude shares what fills his stomach and his soul. And a few laughs with comedians Mike Epps and Ricky Smiley. This hour of the Tavis Smiley Show from PRI, after the news.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Acura, featuring the TL Type S with a 286-horsepower V6 and real-time traffic alerts. Learn more at Acura.com.